Welcome to Learning English on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Today on the show, we have stories from Jonathan Evans, Alice Bryant, John Russell, Ashley Thompson, and me. We also bring you another American story. But first, here is Alice Bryant.
The United States last added a group to its list of foreign terrorist organizations on June 30th, 2016. On that day, the Obama administration put Al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent on the list. It said the group carried out attacks in Pakistan and murdered writers and activists in Bangladesh. President Donald Trump is considering adding two more groups, the Muslim Brotherhood and Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas lost out to Trump for the Republican Party presidential nomination. He and other Republicans in Congress last month proposed bills that ask Trump to consider adding the Brotherhood and Iran's Revolutionary Guard to the terrorist list. It is time to call this enemy by its name and speak with clarity and moral authority, Cruz said. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is Iran's main security group. It also controls large parts of Iran's economy and is a major influence on its politics. Opponents of naming the Iranian Guard a terrorist organization worry the move could do more harm than good. They say it likely would increase support for Iranian hardliners, reducing the influence of moderate leaders. The Muslim Brotherhood wants countries to be governed by Islamic law. The Muslim Brotherhood's Mohamed Morsi was elected president of Egypt in 2012. But he was removed by the military, led by Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, 1 year later. After taking over as the country's president, al-Sisi has banned the Muslim Brotherhood. And he has been calling on the U.S. to add the group to its terrorist list. There is also opposition to putting the Muslim Brotherhood on the terrorist list. The Council on American-Islamic Relations works to protect civil liberties of American Muslims. Ibrahim Cooper speaks for the group, which also opposes President Trump's executive order blocking travel to the U.S. from 7 majority Muslim nations. A court has put the order on hold. Cooper told VOA that those pushing for the terrorist declaration are trying to connect American Muslims to the Muslim Brotherhood. Such a declaration, he said, would be used in a political campaign to attack American Muslims. But important advisors to President Trump support the terrorist declaration for the Brotherhood. Among them is his chief strategist, Stephen Bannon, the former head of Breitbart News. He has called the Brotherhood the foundation of modern terrorism. Sean Spicer is the press secretary for President Trump. He would not say if Trump is ready to declare the Brotherhood and Iran's Revolutionary Guard terrorist organizations. But, he said, the president's main goal is to attack and destroy Islamic terrorism. American people and businesses are prohibited from doing business with groups on the Foreign Terrorist Organizations list. And the groups and their members are prohibited from using any money or other holdings they own in the U.S. I'm Alice Bryant.
Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed is the new president of Somalia. He defeated incumbent president Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud after two sets of voting. The new leader formerly served as Somalia's prime minister. He holds both Somali and American citizenship. This is a victory for Somalia and the Somalis, Mohamed said after taking the oath of office. This is the beginning of the era of unity, the democracy of Somalia, and the beginning of the fight against corruption. The 54-year-old Mohamed is widely known by the nickname Farmajo. He went to university in New York and served in the Somali embassy in Washington, D.C. in the 1980s. Mohamed sought asylum in the United States following the collapse of the Somali government. He lived in New York and worked for the state government there for many years. However, Mohamed remained closely connected to Somali politics. In 2010, Somalia's president asked him to serve as prime minister. He did so for 8 months until June of 2011. The rebel group Al-Shabaab was at the height of its power during that period. Al-Shabaab threatened to interfere with the voting Wednesday. African Union peacekeepers and government forces enforced strong security measures. The election took place peacefully. Somalia's new president faces many difficulties, including the fight against Al-Shabaab. The country is also troubled with corruption, poverty, and food insecurity. There is a daunting task ahead of me, and I know that, Mohamed said. But for now, many people in Mogadishu appear to be hopeful. Witnesses told VOA's Somali service that public celebrations began in the Somali capital following the announcement. The AP reports that thousands of Somalis happily demonstrated in the streets, chanting the new president's name. Somalia will be another Somalia soon, said Ahmed Ali, a police officer celebrating in the crowd. I'm John Russell.
The United Nations has asked for $2.1 billion to help Yemen, where millions of people are caught in a two-year-old civil war. A Saudi Arabian-led coalition began bombing in the Middle Eastern country 2 years ago. The attacks are in support of the Yemeni government as it battles against a group of rebels called Houthis. UN officials said the airstrikes have destroyed bridges, major roads, entire neighborhoods, and a port. This has left millions of people without electricity, safe water, or food. Stephen O'Brien is the Under Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator for the UN. He said 18.8 million people, or two-thirds of Yemen's population, need humanitarian aid.
Immense human suffering is unfolding in front of our eyes, caused by conflict. 7.3 million people do not know where their next meal is coming from.
O'Brien noted that he was shocked at how thin and sick-looking many of the people were when he visited Yemen a few months ago.
Children and youth were stunted and severely malnourished, barely holding on to their lives. And that was 5 months ago. Since then, the situation in Yemen has just simply got worse.
The UN humanitarian chief warned that current humanitarian efforts are not enough. He said, without immediate action, famine is now a real possibility for 2017. Jamie McGoldrick has been the UN's humanitarian aid coordinator for Yemen since December 2015. He has watched the situation take place and says Yemeni people must make difficult choices to survive.
And so what you have is people having to make life and death decisions. Do you feed your child or your children, or do you pay for medical treatment for the sick child? And that's a daily call for many families.
Historically, Yemen has been one of the poorest countries in the world. McGoldrick said the two-year-long civil war has weakened the country's communities. He said people had so little money they were unable to pay to travel to feeding centers or hospitals where they could find help. The UN official said about 7,500 people have been killed and 40,000 injured since the war began. He added that these numbers cannot be confirmed because people die at home and are buried before they are ever recorded. I'm Jonathan Evans.
American Micah Meyer has an unusual goal. He wants to visit all of the more than 400 properties operated by the National Park Service. He spent January 2017 visiting historic areas in the southeastern United States. One of his first stops was Fort Sumter, a former military position in waters just off the coast of Charleston, South Carolina. Fort Sumter is famous for being the place where the first shot of the Civil War was fired. It is also where the first person killed in the conflict died. After years of rising tensions between northern and southern states, the two sides clashed in Charleston Harbor on April 12, 1861. That was when the Southern Army launched an artillery attack on Fort Sumter. Federal troops surrendered the fort a short time later. Union forces eventually fought to regain control of the base and defeated the South in 1865. As he stood inside the large walls of Fort Sumter National Monument, Micah Meyer looked across the water to the port at Charleston. He imagined what the area must have looked like more than a century and a half ago.
See across that bridge, Charleston, South Carolina. It was under siege at one point for 17 months. There were cannons that could fire from where I'm standing on the fort all the way to the old town.
Meyer also visited the Charles Pinckney National Historic Site in South Carolina. There, he had a chance to learn about Charles Pinckney, who helped write and was a signer of the U.S. Constitution.
Some people call him a forgotten founding father, but he was a political figure of early America who helped shape what our eventual Constitution ended up looking like.
The National Park Service helps care for what remains of Pinckney's former home and farm. Park Service workers tell the stories of 18th century plantation life for free and enslaved people. During his travels in January, Meyer had a surprise. Barack Obama, in his last few days as president, named a new national park site in Beaufort, just south of Charleston. It is called the Reconstruction Era National Monument. The Reconstruction Era stretched from 1861 to 1898. It was a period when Americans struggled with the treatment of newly freed African Americans. The new national monument will help tell that story.
So all within the Charleston, South Carolina area, you have these three sites now that are really related to either America becoming America or America figuring out who America is.
Driving south into the state of Georgia, Meyer stopped at Fort Pulaski National Monument. Many observers believe the creation of Fort Pulaski was a major turning point in U.S. military history. Built in 1861, the former base is considered one of the most modern posts of its time. It had a moat with water that surrounded the whole fort. Down the Florida coast, Meyer stopped at Castillo de San Marcos National Monument in the city of St. Augustine. He also stopped at another former military post, the much smaller Fort Matanzas. Meyer said visiting these historic places helped him recognize the many things the National Park Service does to protect national treasures for all to enjoy. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.
Now it's time for the American story, The Black Cat, by Edgar Allan Poe.
Tomorrow I die. Tomorrow I die. And today I want to tell the world what happened, and thus perhaps free my soul from the horrible weight which lies upon it. But listen. Listen, and you shall hear how I have been destroyed. When I was a child, I had a natural goodness of soul which led me to love animals, all kinds of animals, but especially those animals we call pets, animals which have learned to live with men and share their homes with them. There is something in the love of these animals which speaks directly to the heart of the man who has learned from experience how uncertain and changeable is the love of other men. I was quite young when I married. You will understand the joy I felt to find that my wife shared with me my love for animals. Quickly she got for us several pets of the most likable kind. We had birds, some goldfish, a fine dog, and a cat. The cat was a beautiful animal, of unusually large size and entirely black. I named the cat Pluto, and it was the pet I liked best. I alone fed it, and it followed me all around the house. It was even with difficulty that I stopped it from following me through the streets. Our friendship lasted in this manner for several years, during which, however, my own character became greatly changed. I began to drink too much wine and other strong drinks. As the days passed, I became less loving in my manner. I became quick to anger. I forgot how to smile and laugh. My wife, yes, and my pets too, all except the cat, were made to feel the change in my character. One night I came home quite late from the inn where I now spent more and more time drinking. Walking with uncertain step, I made my way with effort into the house. As I entered, I saw, or thought I saw, that Pluto the cat was trying to stay out of my way, to avoid me. This action by an animal which I had thought still loved me made me angry beyond reason. My soul seemed to fly from my body. I took a small knife out of my coat and opened it. Then I took the poor animal by the neck, and with one quick movement I cut out one of its fear-filled eyes. Slowly the cat got well. The hole where its eye had been was not a pretty thing to look at, it's true, but the cat no longer appeared to suffer any pain. As might be expected, however, it ran from me in fear whenever I came near. Why should it not run? Yet this did not fail to anger me. I felt growing inside myself a new feeling. Who has not 100 times found himself doing wrong, some evil thing, for no other reason than because he knows he should not? Are not we humans at all times pushed, ever driven in some unknown way, to break the law just because we understand it to be the law? One day, in cold blood, I tied a strong rope around the cat's neck, and taking it down to the cellar under the house, I hung it from one of the wood beams above my head. I hung it there until it was dead. I hung it there with tears in my eyes. I hung it there because I knew it had loved me, because I felt it had given me no reason to hurt it, because I knew that my doing so was a wrong so great, a sin so deadly, that it would place my soul forever outside the reach of the love of God. That same night, as I lay sleeping, I heard through my open window the cries of our neighbors. I jumped from my bed and found that the entire house was filled with fire. It was only with great difficulty that my wife and I escaped. And when we were out of the house, all we could do was stand and watch it burn to the ground. I thought of the cat as I watched it burn, the cat whose dead body I had left hanging in the cellar. It seemed almost that the cat had, in some mysterious way, caused the house to burn, so that it could make me pay for my evil act, so that it could take revenge upon me. Months went by, and I could not drive the thought of the cat out of my mind. One night I sat in the inn drinking as usual. In the corner I saw a dark object that I had not seen before. I went over to see what it could be. It was a cat. A cat almost exactly like Pluto. I touched it with my hand and petted it, passing my hand softly along its back. The cat rose and pushed its back against my hand. Suddenly, I realized that I wanted the cat. I offered to buy it from the innkeeper, but he claimed he had never seen the animal before. As I left the inn, it followed me, and I allowed it to do so. It soon became a pet of both my wife and myself. The morning after I brought it home, however, I discovered that this cat, like Pluto, had only one eye. How was it possible that I had not noticed this the night before? This fact only made my wife love the cat even more, but I myself found a feeling of dislike growing in me. My growing dislike of the animal only seemed to increase its love for me. It followed me everywhere, always. When I sat, it lay down under my chair. When I stood up, it got between my feet and nearly made me fall. Wherever I went, it was always there. At night, I dreamed of it, and I began to hate that cat. One day, my wife called to me from the cellar of the old building where we were now forced to live. As I went down the stairs, the cat, following me as always, ran under my feet and nearly threw me down. In sudden anger, I took a knife and struck wildly at the cat. Quickly, my wife put out her hand and stopped my arm. This only increased my anger, and without thinking, I turned and put the knife's point deep into her heart, and she fell to the floor and died without a sound. I spent a few moments looking for the cat, but it was gone. And I had other things to do, for I knew I must do something with the body, and quickly. Suddenly I noted a place in the wall of the cellar, where stones had been added to the wall to cover an old fireplace which was no longer wanted. The walls were not very strongly built, and I found I could easily take down those stones. Behind them there was, as I knew there must be, a hole just big enough to hold the body. With much effort, I put the body in and carefully put the stones back in their place. I was pleased to see that it was quite impossible for anyone to know that a single stone had been moved. Days passed. Still there was no cat. People came and asked about my wife, but I answered them easily. Then one day several officers of the police came. Certain that they would find nothing, I asked them in and went with them as they searched. Finally they searched the cellar from end to end. I watched them quietly, and as I expected, they noticed nothing. But as they started up the stairs again, I felt myself driven by some unknown inner force to let them know, to make them know, that I had won the battle. "The walls of this building," I said, "are very strongly built. It is a fine old house." And as I spoke, I struck with my stick the very place in the wall behind which was the body of my wife. Immediately, I felt a cold feeling up and down my back as we heard coming out of the wall itself a horrible cry. For one short moment, the officers stood looking at each other. Then quickly they began to pick at the stones, and in a short time they saw before them the body of my wife, black with dried blood and smelling of decay. On the body's head, its one eye filled with fire, its wide open mouth the color of blood, sat the cat, crying out its revenge.
For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver.